I'm Jesse Brown, and today we're talking about the prescription drugs that as many as 15% of Canadians are on, and the extreme and rarely discussed side effects that they can sometimes cause.
I woke up one morning and instantly knew something has gone terribly wrong. Something's wrong with my body, and I quickly realized I'd lost all sexual sensation in my body. And there was like a dulling of tactile sensation in my genital region, and it's just never gone away.
Wait for that. The woman you just heard is named Emily Gray. She's been living with a condition known as PSSD for 6 years now. Emily is a co-founder of an NGO that deals with this issue. It's called PSSD Canada. PSSD stands for post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. And as Emily said in our opening clip, PSSD can lead to the effective erasure of a person's sexual sensation and functioning. The SSRIs that seem to be at the heart of this condition are selective serotonin uptake inhibitors, a group of antidepressant drugs that have been around for decades. The latest numbers indicate that nearly 20% of Canadian women and 10% of Canadian men are on these drugs. And it is generally known that there are side effects, and a loss of libido is a pretty common one when you're on these drugs. But what we're talking about today, and what advocates like Emily have been saying for years, is that the side effects can be very extreme, and they might persist even after you stop taking SSRIs. That would be the post part of PSSD, post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. Emily is going to join us today to talk about her experience. We'll also be speaking with Dr. David Healy, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Cardiff in Wales. Dr. Healy has been involved in SSRI research for decades. He's the author of over a dozen books on psychopharmacology, including Let Them Eat Prozac, The Unhealthy Relationship Between the Pharmaceutical Industry and Depression. Also on our panel is Dr. Caroline Pakal, a psychology professor at Queen's University, whose research focuses on sexual well-being and includes sexual psychophysiology. And one thing that I've got to note before we get into today's show is that when it comes to matters of science, especially medical science, things that have to do with public health, your health, we understand that a podcast is not where contentious issues get settled. A lot of listeners say that we should just let science speak, but science is often inconclusive. Science is often contrasting and conflicting voices trying to figure out what is true. The way to reach what is true is not by having a debate on a podcast. Today, you're going to hear some expert commentary about these medications. These are not the only experts out there. But what these experts have to say, and what Emily has to say about what's happened to her own body, all of this, we think, is worth listening to. Wait for it. I'm going to ask you each just to briefly introduce yourself. Tell me where you are and who you are, beginning with you, Emily.
My name's Emily Gray. I'm from Vancouver Island, and I am a six-year now sufferer of PSSD. I advocate and try and raise my voice about the condition and try to empower others to do the same.
Yes, I'm David Healy. I've been working in the psychiatric field for over 40 years or so. Before the SSRIs came on the market, I did a PhD on the serotonin system, which left me well-placed to get a feel for the issues linked to this group of drugs.
Hi, my name is Caroline Pakal. I'm a professor of psychology at Queen's University in Kingston. I'm also a Canada Research Chair in Sexual Health, and a lot of my work exists at sort of the intersections of patient symptoms that are distressing yet grossly misunderstood by the field of research as well as the medical profession.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you for having us, Jesse.
Thanks for having us.
Emily, if we could start with you, can you talk about PSSD? What is it?
Absolutely. So PSSD stands for post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. It is essentially a medical injury that can develop in people during or upon withdrawal of an SSRI drug. People also experience the same symptom set sometimes from SNRIs and from tricyclic antidepressants. And there's a wide range of severity within the symptom set. But the core symptom is a reduction or removal of sexual function and sexuality in general that persists long after the drug has been taken. So you might stop your treatment and then there will be a withdrawal period. But if it persists longer than 3 months, then it can be classified as PSSD. But it can go on in some people for months. It can go on for years. It can be indefinite. I'm at the 6-year mark. I took my last dose of citalopram in March 6 years ago when I was 23 years old. And I'm almost 30 now. And I have a complete elimination of my sexuality that began very suddenly during the withdrawal of citalopram, which is an SSRI. This is a common story within the PSSD community, and people experience devastating relationship breakdown, a really wide range of impacts on their lives. It has a huge impact on self-esteem, general quality of life, and you also have emotional blunting and quite frequently cognitive symptoms that appear alongside the core sexual symptoms.
I'm so sorry, and I'm grateful to you for talking with me about this. I imagine that some people who suffer from this are reluctant to talk about it publicly.
Yeah, and that's a huge, huge part of why this has gone under-recognized for so long, because it is just not something that people typically bring up, even in a confidential clinical setting. So I've talked to people, quite a lot of them, who maybe will attempt tentatively to bring it up with their doctor, but then they receive a little bit of, you know, something that they feel is dismissive, or the doctor will just say, oh no, SSRIs can't cause that, and then they'll retreat and they won't bring it up again. And it only takes one experience like that for people to just shut down and not want to talk about it at all, because it takes so much for them to bring it up in the first place. And that's in a confidential doctor-to-patient setting. You know, this is not something that people are talking about around the water cooler. So this is very underreported. There's just not even close to enough public awareness. And that's part of the reason that it's flown under the radar this long.
And how long were you on SSRIs before you stopped, and now you're 6 years off of them and still having this loss of sexual function? How long were you on the medication?
So I was prescribed an SSRI, citalopram, when I was 17 years old, and then I was on it at a relatively low dose throughout the next 4 years, not 100% consistently. Sometimes I would try to taper off it, but it was always just low-dose citalopram. It wasn't polypharmacy for me. It was just that one drug. And then over time, I began to notice it impacting my intimate relationships more and more, and I decided to taper off at the age of 22. And then I was tapering throughout the period of my 23rd birthday. And so at 23, during this taper process, I woke up one morning and instantly knew something has gone terribly wrong. I've lost something. Something's wrong with my body. And I quickly realized I'd lost all sensation, all sexual sensation in my body. And there was like a dulling of tactile sensation in my genital region. And it's just never gone away.
I think that there's like a general awareness that there can be sexual side effects with this medication. I once had a psychiatrist say to me, you know, people know from the ads and whatnot that like sexual side effects can occur. You might have some loss of libido. Let me tell you something. They probably will occur in my experience. But I think that the people who know that think of it as something that happens while you're on the medication. What you're telling me, that 6 years after you have lost sensation and even emotional effects like of romantic feeling, that is new information to me. Dr. Pukal, to the question of how common, is there anything known about how many people experience this?
A general population study showed that it was about 4% of 100,000 people was the rate, which points to it being quite rare indeed. However, I believe it is more common than that tiny little number. Working in this area, interacting with a lot of patients who have this, I'm also a clinical psychologist, and so I certainly do support and help treat individuals with PSSD in as much as a psychologist can. And so I would argue that, you know, it is not as rare as one might think, but the numbers I'm giving you are just simply estimates, but they're not accurate as far as the research goes.
Even, you know, subjective terms like rare or relatively rare, to Dr. Healy's point, when you're talking about medication that is used as widespread as this is, rare is still a whole hell of a lot of people. I have here in front of me that 20% of Canadian women and 10% of Canadian men are on these drugs. So 4% of those, we're going to test my math here, but thousands and tens, hundreds of thousands of people. It's shocking to me because when people are suffering depression or anxiety and you're told, here's a drug that can really work wonders for you, it can really have life-changing effects, and you may have sexual side effects. If you're suffering every day, obviously a lot of people will take that gamble. If you were to tell people, I know you're experiencing depression or anxiety, we have something that might help with that. However, you may lose all sexual function for the rest of your life and have numb genitals and not be able to experience love. I think that your buy-in would be a lot lower.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it's almost the opposite of what you said. You know, the first thing you said, which is you will have sexual side effects. You may get a benefit.
This episode is brought to you by Article. Listen, we take our patio season seriously here in this country of ours, and we should. This is our time in the sun, people. But is your patio furniture meeting the moment? Article is a Canadian furniture company, and they have great stuff for inside your home or office. But not everybody realizes just how great their outdoor furniture is. I have a patio set from Article, and frankly, it's kind of nicer than our living room. I love this stuff. The Article furniture on our patio is high quality, well-crafted. It looks great season after season. If you need to upgrade your patio game, check out article.com/CanadaLand. They ship directly to you. I think you'll be surprised at just how stylish their outdoor furniture is given the price point. Really competitive given the quality of the stuff that Article makes. You can also take advantage of this great deal. They're offering listeners of CanadaLand $50 off your first purchase of $100 or more. To claim this, visit article.com/CanadaLand. The discount will be automatically applied at checkout. That's article.com/CanadaLand for $50 off of your first purchase of $100 or more. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp, and BetterHelp are focusing right now on workplace stress. I'm here with Noor. Noor, you've like settled into like regular hosting. How's your stress?
Yeah, I'm pretty stressed, but trying to manage. You know how it is.
I do. I think it's just something that comes along with caring about what you do, mm-hmm. which is not to say that it's not something you got to monitor, you got to stay on top of it, and it's not something that you're just going to turn off. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's not the right goal. It's like, I leave that at work. Personally speaking, it's about a practice of knowing that this stuff kind of lingers with you, knowing that anxiety and stress, and sometimes, you know, kind of like manic elation if you're excited, all of it like follows you outside of the newsroom, and having somebody to talk about it with helps a lot. I like telling our listeners about BetterHelp because BetterHelp is the largest online therapy provider, which means that they're better than anyone at just connecting people with mental health professionals, mm-hmm. which is a big part of the process is just how many people don't get help because they just don't know where to start or they find it daunting. You want a therapist that gets you and that you're going to click with. And if it's not, you can switch therapists. I think that's a really big feature. Like I said, BetterHelp is the largest online therapy provider in the world. They can provide access to mental health professionals with a diverse variety of expertise. So talk it out with BetterHelp. Listeners of CanadaLand get 10% off of their first month at betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. That's betterhelp.com/CanadaLand. I want to be very, very careful as a layperson, as a broadcaster who is not a scientist here. There is a lot of controversy around these drugs. They are widely used, probably some of the most prevalent medications out there, but there are people who are passionately against them for a number of reasons. Everyone from Scientologists who have taken aim at psychiatry to naturopaths. There's a huge anti-pharmaceutical sentiment out there, which is justified in many cases, but it has led to a widespread suspicion. I don't want to give people bad medical information on the show, especially when my understanding is that all of these complications notwithstanding, SSRIs are miracle drugs that save lives. What is the balance that we want to reach here? Because the three of you are appearing on this not a science program, but a program for kind of the general interest listener, to raise some pretty alarming red flags that would certainly give me pause before considering this medication. Do either of the doctors present here feel that these drugs are appropriate in some cases, or am I talking to two doctors who are like anti-SSRI doctors?
Let me talk first here, because I'm able to actually give the drugs to people, okay? And I don't want these drugs removed from the market. They can be helpful. They're not miracle drugs. If you're severely depressed, I would use one of the older antidepressants, not an SSRI, because they're not particularly helpful for people who are very severely depressed. They roughly help perhaps about half the people that get put on them, and they don't help the other half. It's a bit like an LSD trip. You can have people who do well on the drug and people who do poorly. In terms of being able to treat people, they're just one of the different kinds of antidepressants we have, and it's good to have them because there are people who will be helped by them. But it's terribly important to remember that there are people who aren't going to be helped. At the first hint that they don't suit you, we need to change to a different drug, or consider the possibility that, well, you're going to get well without these drugs anyway. It may take a few weeks, it may take a few months, but I'm happy to keep meeting with you to keep an eye on things and ensure that they work out the right way.
And Dr. Pukal?
I also agree with Dr. Healy. I think they are absolutely an option to prescribe for individuals. As a psychologist, I do not prescribe medications myself. I do find that doing an assessment, a very careful assessment of a person's severity, of their history of depression, coming up with appropriate diagnosis, that is actually key in terms of informing the kind of treatment that a patient will get. This may involve particular kinds of antidepressants. It may involve therapy. It may involve a combination of the two. What I am finding is that people present to their family doctors or to a physician at a clinic, and they say that they've been feeling a bit low, a little bit down. There's no careful assessment. There's no really looking at a person's function, looking at having a discussion around the different options that are there. I find that a lot of SSRIs are being used as first-line treatment, and prescriptions are just handed out to patients without careful assessment, without careful follow-up, without careful conversations about the potential side effects, without even referral to non-pharmacological options such as psychotherapy that has been proven by science to work for depression symptoms. So I find that there's a lot of carelessness when it comes to prescribing these medications, and that there's not a lot of informed consent around that process. And there's also not a shared narrative that we have in society to be able to tolerate feelings of sadness or feeling low. It's almost like you're not supposed to have them. You need a fix for that. But it is part of a range of our human emotions. And it is only usually a problem if it's associated with a lot of distress, a lot of dysfunction in terms of being able to go to work, in terms of being able to get out of bed. And so I find that conversations around depression do not really account for sort of regular sort of ranges of expression. Everything seems to be pathologized to a certain extent. So I do believe medications serve a purpose, but I do believe they need to be used very carefully. I think that careful assessments need to be done. And I think that very specific conversations about the risks of any medications also need to be had.
Jesse, can I bring us back quickly to a point Emily made, which is it's not just about informed consent. I mean, if you get told there can be problems, people will often say, oh, yes, I'm happy to go ahead and have the pills anyway. But as Emily brought out, one of the problems that PSSD highlights is the fact that you go back to your doctor after you have a problem and you get faced with doctors saying, well, we just don't believe you. You must be depressed. Let's increase the dose of your pills. So it's not just informed consent, it's the response of doctors after you have a problem. Very few of them are able to entertain the possibility that they've really harmed you and try and work with you to see if there are ways to try and put this right.
Emily, has that happened to you?
It has, and it hasn't been every doctor. There have been some who have been responsive and wanting to learn more and to listen, but there's a lot of just ignorance about the condition because it is understudied and underreported. So yes, there absolutely are some who just, they don't want to hear it. It goes against their worldview. There are others who are very interested in learning more and who are caring, but they can't do anything for you because they just don't have anything that they can offer you.
And because loss of libido is, my understanding is that when you're feeling down, if you are depressed, you might be less interested in sex. That might be hard to distinguish from an after effect of the drug.
Like, that can be true in some cases. Some cases of PSSD are reducible to a reduction in libido, but we're talking about for often years at a time. And other cases of PSSD are far more severe than that, as in a total loss of sexual sensation entirely, as in your genitals feel like your elbow. It can come with erectile dysfunction for men. It can come with, you know, lack of lubrication for women. And also there's these cognitive and emotional symptoms, which often appear at the same time. And for me, this was a very rapid switch. I literally went to bed feeling normal, or at least what my baseline was during the taper. And then I woke up in the morning with this symptom set that has never gone away. So, you know, there's no evidence that depression can cause a symptom set like that.
Can I ask our doctors about that? Because that just sounds horrifying. But they also sound like two different things. To lose sensation physically feels like, and again, I'm asking this as a layperson trying to get my head around this, a neurological problem. If I just couldn't feel something in a very sensitive part of my body, I would think that there's something, some nerve damage. But to not be able to experience certain emotions, in my kind of like taxonomy of where things come from, that feels like it's coming from a separate part of my biology than a loss of physical sensation. What do you understand about why this is happening? Please explain this to me as if I am a slow child, because I sort of am when it comes to these things.
You said that, look, loss of libido sounds like the kind of thing that can happen when you're depressed anyway. But people who are depressed don't say to you that I can take a hard bristled brush and rub it up and down my genitals and feel nothing.
I've never heard a depressed person say that. That's true.
No. So once you hear that, you kind of realize that this is not a mood disorder. This is something else. It's, as you said, a neuropathy of some sort. Now, what the SSRI group of drugs do is they act on the sensory receptor system. Whether you think the problems in the brain are in the peripheral nerves around the body feeding into the brain isn't clear at this point, but that's roughly where the problem lies. At the moment, we don't think the damage is permanent in that some people do recover or have windows where they improve a bit. So, you know, if we could get people researching this, there's hope that we can work out what's going on and put it right. And the big tragedy here isn't just that people aren't able to talk about it or get laughed at when they talk about it. It's the fact that no one's doing any research on what's going on here in order to try and put things right.
That's helpful. And that's from our medical doctor present, and from Dr. Pukal, our psychologist. Is that compatible with your understanding of this? Are there different theories at play? Because I take it that this is not a terribly well understood thing.
It's not well understood at all. Theories are pretty limited in terms of action specifically, but I certainly do agree with Dr. Healy in that there is some kind of neuropathy that is involved in the development and the maintenance of these symptoms.
Emily, you're speaking about very intimate things, and I think doing so bravely in the hopes that it'll help other people and perhaps yourself if people care more about this. I will take that as an invitation to ask you more questions, but if anything I ask you is too personal or too intimate, please.
Ask away. It's okay.
Has anything helped?
Short answer, no. Initially, I had pretty severe cognitive symptoms that accompanied it, and those have dissipated to a substantial degree. So initially, I was having like constant memory problems and sleep issues as well. And that seems to have faded over the 6 years I've had it, but the sexual symptoms are still 100% there. So I've been left completely asexual and sexually dysfunctional because of this run of medications.
Emily, you mentioned that you were put on this medication. Was it in your teens?
I was 17, yes.
Emily, what made you decide at the age of 17 to go on this medication? How badly were you suffering when you went on this medication in the first place?
I mean, I had had pretty persistently low mood for a couple of years at that point. Throughout the year that I was 16, I had had an eating disorder where I'd been restricting food fairly severely. And though that had cleared up through like talk interventions to a large extent. By the time I was put on the drug, I was still experiencing a lot of negative emotions around myself and my body. But like in retrospect, a lot of that was not atypical for an adolescent girl. Like Carolyn and David Healy have both pointed out, SSRIs are frontline treatment. Like they're offered quite early on. It wasn't presented as the only option, but it was presented as a very safe option to try. And that if they made me feel better, then I could take them. If it didn't work, then I could just come off them. And it wasn't presented as something that could have long-range consequences. So I went on them. I did feel a sense of stabilization. And then right after that, like I was off to university, ended up being on them for 4 years pretty consistently. But in retrospect, there was no good reason for me to be on them for 4 years like that. And I would never advise my own child in that same position to look at a pharmaceutical option for something like that. Again, I'm not anti-medication. I'm pro-informed consent. But the conversations about how people come to view these medications as both necessary and safe needs to be part of that consent process.
I'm aware that a lot of children are given these drugs.
Adolescence is a time when a lot of people end up being prescribed an SSRI, and some people are even younger. You know, some people are kids when they are put on these medications. It definitely raises issues around informed consent, because as both Professor Pakal and Professor Healy were saying, an adult can weigh up the risks and say, is this risk worth it to me to try this treatment? A child who does not have a sexual baseline, because they haven't had a chance to develop one yet, cannot consent to having their sexuality permanently stunted. I personally know people who were put on these in early adolescence. The specific person I'm thinking of started SSRIs when she was 11, and then slowly as she grew up throughout her teens, realized that she didn't have a normal sexual response. And it took her a long time to remember back, think what could have caused this. She's never had an orgasm in her life. So it's impossible to know what her sexual baseline would have been otherwise. But the fact that we know that these drugs can permanently remove someone's sexual function and that they're being prescribed to people who are still in the thick of their mental development is quite disturbing, and it raises serious ethical questions.
Emily, I'm imagining that your reason for speaking out about this is, well, why don't I ask you, because I can see a lot of benefit for people to destigmatize it just so people can get support from each other. But are you hopeful for a cure?
I mean, that's a huge question mark. It really depends on if we're able to get the research into what actually causes it. It's probably going to be a really long road. I have no idea. I don't have an answer to whether or not there's going to be a cure to this. I can certainly speak to the profound effects on a person's life. You know, when you think about the role sex actually plays in our lives in terms of just feeling like yourself, feeling like it's part of your identity, and also people find partnerships and build families through their sexual relationship. Like your marital relationship or your long-term partnership is a core aspect of most people's lives. And if your ability to do that has been gutted, a lot of people just feel a great deal of despair about their future. Sexual disfigurement and the attendant shame that can come with that is something that strikes at the core of who you are, and it eats away at you. So will there be a cure? The short answer is simply, I don't know. I can't give you an answer to that. I also know people in the wider community who have taken their lives due to this condition, and it's heartbreaking, and I get it.
I have to ask Dr. Pukal and Dr. Healy, given that these are some of the most widely prescribed medications in existence, I suspect that we're going to be flooded with email after publishing this from people who feel very strongly otherwise. Are you outliers? Are these sort of rebel opinions in the medical community that don't reflect the wider consensus? Dr. Pukal?
I'm not an outlier per se. Like my world of research is in sexual symptoms that are not well understood. This can be pain. It could be arousal in the body. It could be PSSD symptoms. What I'm doing is I've launched some research in this area along with Emily and another PSSD sufferer, as well as a team of researchers. We are trying to understand, it's not pathophysiological in nature, but we're trying to understand lived experiences of PSSD in order to then inform individuals, medical professionals, the lay public about this condition so that people are aware of it at the levels of perhaps being an SSRI user and being more informed about choice and treatment, or being a healthcare provider and having better conversations and follow-up with patients on SSRIs. This is well within my wheelhouse in terms of sort of my research approach, where I don't